Chapter 22. In a country that for all intents and purposes was 100% ethnically homogeneous, Eddie Seng should have been at a disadvantage when the chairman had given him and Holly Kasim the job of tailing their harbor pilot. He hadn't complained, though. Like Juan, he felt there was something suspicious about Assad, some quality that had made the hairs on the back of his neck stand erect. Having a suspicion and proving it were two separate things, though, and there was no getting around the fact that every one of Eddie's relatives going back a couple hundred generations was Chinese, and nearly all the people walking the streets of Tripoli were born in the Middle East. But it wasn't quite all bad. There wasn't a city on the planet that didn't have an enclave of Chinese immigrants. And on that first night, while Holly trailed Tariq Assad, carrying a hand-lettered card proclaiming he was a mute to cover the fact that he spoke no Arabic, Eddie had gone off in search of Tripoli's Chinatown. What he found came as a shock, though upon reflection, it shouldn't have been. Buoyed by petrodollars, Libya, and especially Tripoli, was undergoing a building boom, and a number of the projects were being erected by construction firms out of Hong Kong and Shanghai. Apart from the workers brought in, there was also a large support system of restaurants, bars, shops, and brothels, catering strictly to a Chinese clientele that was nearly indistinguishable from Eddie's New York Chinatown home. And like New York, there were both legitimate and illegitimate layers of society. It had taken him only a few minutes of wandering to find gang symbols that he recognized, spray-painted on a couple of the storefronts, and a few minutes more to see the symbol he wanted. It was small, just a few inches tall, and was sprayed in red paint on an otherwise plain gray metal door. The door was set in a heavy-duty structure of a warehouse, with a row of windows running only along the second floor. Eddie knocked, using a code he knew from home. No one answered the door, so he knocked again, this time as a civilian would, a few hard raps with his knuckles. Judging by the dull echo he heard, he guessed the door was solid steel. The door creaked open after a few seconds, and a boy of about 10 poked his head around the jamb. There would be 3 or 4 armed men just out of sight. The boy didn't say a word. Neither did Eddie. He pulled out the tails of his shirt and turned, exposing his back up to the shoulder blades. The boy gasped aloud, and suddenly Eddie felt other eyes on him. He slowly lowered his shirt again and faced the door. He took it as a good sign that the two gang members now studying him had their pistols lowered.
"Who are you?"
one asked. "A friend," Eddie replied.
"Who gave you the tattoo?" asked the second.
Eddie glanced at him with as much disdain as he dared.
"No one gave it to me. I earned it."
On his back was inked an elaborate, though now faded, tattoo of a dragon fighting a griffin. It was an old gang symbol of the Green Dragon Tong, from when they had battled a rival gang for control of the Shanghai docks back in the 1930s. Only senior members of the Tong or especially brave foot soldiers were allowed it on their skin, and given the global reach of the Chinese underworld, Eddie had known it would gain him entree here. He just hoped they didn't test it, because Kevin Nixon had applied the stencil only a few hours earlier from a catalog of gang and prison tattoos he kept aboard the Oregon.
"What are you doing here?"
the first thug asked. "There's a man who works at the harbor. He owes people I represent a great deal of money. I want to hire some of your guys to help me keep an eye on him until it's time to collect."
"You have money?"
Eddie didn't bother to answer. No one in their right mind would make such a request without being able to pay for it. 4 or 5 days, 8 or 10 guys, $10,000.
"Too tough to exchange. Make it euros. 10,000.
With the currency rates the way they were, that was almost 50% more. Eddie nodded. And just like that, he had enough men to keep Tariq Assad under 24-hour watch while he and Holly waited in a flea-bag hotel that the Tong controlled. The gang supplied updates on Assad's movements every 6 hours via disposable cell phones, so over the course of a few days, they had a pretty good pattern of his movements. Generally, Assad worked 8 hours on the night shift at the dock, though he would usually take off for a couple if no ships were expected. On those nights, he went to an apartment not too far from the harbor where he kept a mistress. She wasn't the prettiest of the ones he frequented, but she was the most convenient. After work, he went home to be with his family, slept maybe 6 hours, and then went out to have coffee with co-workers before visiting other apartments dotted around Tripoli. Eddie asked his new employees to put together a list of the women's names, and when he asked Eric Stone to cross-reference them using the Oregon's computer, it came back that Assad was bedding the wives of mid-level government employees. Even the plain girl near the harbor was the sister of the deputy director of the Energy Ministry. Given that Assad wasn't particularly attractive by anyone's standards, his conquests were all the more impressive. Eddie and Holly both concluded that Assad was nothing more than a mildly corrupt harbor pilot with an overactive libido and one hell of a pickup line. That was until Max Hanley called with his bombshell announcement. Assad's ingratiation into the bedrooms of Libya's government took on a whole new and darker aspect. Juan listened over the phone as Eric Stone described the route the old rail spur took through the mountains toward the coast, 20-odd miles away. The satellite pictures didn't give the gradient of the line, but Juan's tracking chip put him at nearly 1,000 feet above sea level when he'd gotten off the helicopter at the terrorists' training camp. From the outline of a plan that was forming in his mind even as Eric spoke, Cabrillo decided it was going to be one hell of a wild ride. Worse, though, the timing was going to be incredibly tight, and he could think of no excuse he could have Overholt pass on to the Libyans to delay their assault without tipping his hand. Adding to his problems, he hadn't slept more than 6 hours out of the past 48, and judging by the appearance of his 3 shipmates, they weren't faring much better. "What is it?" Link asked, his surgical gloves covered with blood as he finished the last of the tight stitches. He had sewn the cut in Juan's leg by layering 3 rows of catgut, moving from the deepest part of the wound out to the skin, so there was no way it would reopen. With a local anesthetic keeping the pain to a dull ache, Juan felt confidence in his body's abilities.
"What?"
"You just chuckled," Link replied, snapping off the gloves and stuffing them into a red biohazard containment box.
"Did I? I was just thinking that we are so deep over our heads right now, I don't know if what I have in mind is going to work."
"Not another of your infamous Plan C's," Linda groaned. She stood just outside of the pig, looking over Link's massive shoulder.
"That's why I laughed. Gallows humor.
We're well past C and into D, E, or F." There were 2 options facing Cabrillo, but no real choices. He was about to put them all into a shooting gallery, with the pig playing the role of sitting duck. Link duct-taped a gauze pad over Juan's wound and said, "If Doc Huxley has a problem with my work, tell her to take it up with your HMO. Juan struggled back into his pants. They were ripped in 12 places and so crusted with sand that they crackled when he drew them over his hips, but the pig didn't carry any spare uniforms. He did a couple of deep knee bends when he leapt to the ground. The cut was tight, but both the stitches and the anesthesia held. The sun had yet to show itself over the distant mountains, so the stars blazed cold and implacable overhead. Cabrillo studied them for a second, wondering, and not for the first time, if he would live to see them again. "Mount up," he called. "The show's going to be mostly over by the time the Oregon arrives, and we've got a lot of grim work ahead of us."
"Just curious, Juan," Link said casually. "Who are these people we're going to rescue? Political prisoners? Common criminals? What?"
"I think maybe they're the key to this whole thing." Link gave a little nod.
"All right.
If you ask me," Mark said and started to add, "I've got a bad feeling about..." Cabrillo cut him off with a look. 48 minutes by Juan's watch ticked by before he judged they were ready. Barely. He had seen the quality of the guards looking after the prisoners and knew they weren't a serious threat in small numbers. But there were 40 or so of them, and if his timing was off, the 200 more he hoped to lure from the training camp would reach the mine before everyone had made good their escape. On their approach to the mine, they had left Link to make his way to higher ground overlooking the stockyard behind the old administration buildings. With a Barrett 50-caliber sniper rifle, the ex-SEAL could have accurately hit targets from well over a mile away. His effective range with the smaller Rec 7 assault rifle was still an impressive 700 yards, and for what Juan had planned, Link would be taking significantly shorter shots than that. The pig was just out of sight of the mining camp, atop the narrow trail where the day before the Desert Patrol had returned with the body of the escapee. Dawn was a brush stroke in the distance, so darkness filled the hollows and gullies around them, and the air carried the chill of the distant sea. Juan wished there was a way he could leave Alana and their new companion, Fadl, out of the fight, but he couldn't risk leaving them in the desert in case he and his team couldn't return. He had explained his plan to them, made sure they understood the dangers involved, and both were ready to do whatever he asked of them. "Just so you fit in with all the other archaeologist adventurers out there, I'll get you a fedora," he said, and smiled at Alana when she had told him she was game. "And a whip?" she'd joked back. "Kinky," he'd admonished with another grin. "Comm check," Link called over the tactical net. "I've got you 5x5, big man." "I'm on top of the old ore loading structure," the sniper reported. "The guards are starting to roust the prisoners for breakfast. It's now or never." "Roger," Juan replied, and swallowed hard, his throat suddenly as dry as the desert sand. He looked across the driver's seat to Mark Murphy. The success or failure of Juan's plan hinged on Murph's virtuosity with the pig's weapon systems. "Ready?" Mark nodded. "Tally-ho," Juan said. Mark keyed up the pig's roof-mounted mortars. They had already been sighted in with Link's help using a laser rangefinder. They fired simultaneously, and the weapon's autoloader had a second round dropped into each of the four tubes before the first rounds had traveled 100 yards on their high, arcing parabolas. The second fusillade launched with a comically hollow sound, and Mark shouted, "Go!" Juan already had the pig's engine revved, so that when he dropped it into gear, all four tires spun. They roared over a ridge, and the camp came into view. As he'd planned, no one had heard the mortars fire. Ragged prisoners were lining up for their pitifully small breakfast, while guards casually harassed them. He saw one guard use a baton on a man, crashing it into the man's kidneys so hard his back bent like a bow at full stretch, and he collapsed in the dust. The mortar rounds hit the apex of their flight and started barreling earthward, each packed with a kilo of high explosives. Mark had spent part of the drive to the camp removing most of the shrapnel from each round to minimize the chance of hitting any of the detainees. Link laid the crosshairs of his Rec 7 on the guard who'd just clubbed the prisoner, let out half a breath, and squeezed the trigger. "We have pink mist," he reported when the guard's head exploded. He took out another pair of guards before the first ripple of concern passed through the security contingent. The captain of the guards appeared from a tent. His chest was bare, and he wore his uniform pants bloused into his combat boots. Link noted the radio antennae sticking up through a hole in the tent's roof and moved his aim on to another target. Four mortar rounds struck the ground at precisely the same instant. The path leading down to the floor of the open-pit mine erupted in geysers of dirt and greasy fire. A moment later, more rounds hit even closer to the camp. Both guards and prisoners alike pulled back, moving toward the large wooden buildings, while Link continued to thin the ranks of terrorists, one shot, one kill at a time. He made the ones carrying weapons his priority. Cabrillo raced the pig down on the camp like a rally driver dashing for the finish line. Next to him, Murph fought to keep the aiming reticle of the pig's onboard missiles locked on one of the terrorists' trucks. He got tone and fired. The rocket screamed off the rails, carving an erratic path through the air and exploded against the truck's cab, snapping its chassis in half so it rose up like a ship that had been torpedoed. The blast further corralled the frightened prisoners closer to the building, while the guards were rushing back to their tents where many had left their automatic weapons. The pig was 100 yards from the camp when the freshly armed terrorists started running from the tents, brandishing their AKs and firing long strings of rounds in random directions. Up in the pig's cupola, Linda watched them over the sights of her M60 machine gun. The weapon bucked in her arms, slamming into her shoulder like the business end of a jackhammer, but her aim never wavered. The ground around the running gunmen came alive as rounds blew into their midst. Men fell, clutching at horrendous wounds, some struck by their own comrades who had whirled at this new threat and opened fire indiscriminately. "He's had enough time," Juan yelled over the snarling engine. "Take out the command tent." Cabrillo's plan had 2 goals. The first was to rescue as many of the prisoners as he could because he wasn't sure if the Libyan military would take the time to discern friend from foe. He wasn't even sure of their definition of those terms at this point. The second objective was to get as many terrorists as possible away from their training camp before the main attack. If Fiona Katamura was really there, then every gunman engaged at the mine was one less gunman trying to kill her before she was rescued. This was why Link had been told specifically to let the mine's garrison commander contact the training camp on the radio. They needed him to raise the alarm. But now that he had... Mark put a missile through the command tent's front flap at just the right angle for it to hit the ground before it flew through the far side. The canvas rose up on a blossoming column of flame, and the piles of military gear stacked outside were blown flat by the concussion. The tent caught fire like flash paper and turned to ash that fell to the ground like dirty snow. They were deep into the camp now. Above Juan and Murph, Linda continued to work the M60, taking out clusters of guards and using the tracer rounds to keep the prisoners moving toward the stockyard where the terrorists stored their rail cars and train engines. Cabrillo could tell that the guards' will had been broken by the sudden and furious assault. Many of them were running down into the mine or over the ridge and into the desert. 50 or more prisoners were huddled against the side of the old mine office building. A gunman suddenly reared up from behind a bulldozer. He had a perfect bead on the defenseless men and women, and an RPG-7 lifted to his shoulder. Murph flipped the controls from missiles to gun, and the .30 caliber under the pig's snout chattered. The terrorist went down, but not before he fired his rocket-propelled grenade. The 5-pound missile made it less than 10 feet from the tube before it inexplicably exploded in midair.
"Damn, Link," Juan said in awe. "Was that you?"
"It's all a matter of knowing how to read them," Link replied. He would later admit that he was shooting at the terrorist, and the rocket flew into his bullet.
Juan whipped the pig around the side of the building, braking hard so the big truck slid onto a set of tracks, its tail resting just a couple of feet from a boxcar with a handwheel on its roof for brakemen to mechanically slow the antique rolling stock. The track was a good foot narrower than the pig's tires. Juan searched the dash for a second and found the control that could alter the vehicle's ground clearance by pulling in the wheels on articulated suspension joints. He had to jockey the truck back and forth as the wheels drew inward until they were resting directly on the rails, and there was a full 2 feet of open space between the chassis and the crushed rock ballast on the ground. With another button, Juan deactivated the automatic tire inflation system and then jumped from the cab.
"Mark, Linda, get busy," he called over the tactical radio. "Link, cover them. Fodl, with me."
He grabbed up a Rec 7 assault rifle and had the FN-57 pistol in his hand when he hit the ground. He fired at the left side tires. The truck's weight made them go flat instantly, and just like that, the steel rims were cradled around the rails, with the rubber acting as extra grip. He couldn't prevent a satisfied smile. Mating the pig to the railroad tracks had been the cornerstone of his plan. He ran for the corner of the building as his new Libyan friend clambered out of the pig, still wearing his prisoner's rags. Across the compound, he could see a few guards hunting for targets, but for the moment no one was paying the detainees any attention. A couple of them who were pressed against the building looked at Juan fearfully when they saw his weapon. Then Fadl appeared at his side. "Come with us," Fadl told them with an aura of command that didn't surprise the chairman. "These people are here to help." A few of the emaciated prisoners stared back at him uncertainly. "Go. That is an order." Like a breached levee, the few heading toward the rail car that Linda held open turned into a flood. Cabrillo stood at the corner, sweeping the compound for any interested guards. If any looked their way, he put them down, while next to him Fadl waved in more of his people. A group of women appeared from under the overturned serving tables and raced for the building, only to have someone open fire at them from their flank. One of the women went down before Juan could counterfire, hammering home a steady burst into a pyramid of crates from where the shots had originated. The other women helped the injured girl to her feet, supporting her under the arms and making her almost hopscotch to safety. "Bless you," one of them said to Juan as they passed around the building and into protective cover. Another prisoner paused at Juan's side. He gave the man a passing glance and then returned to scanning the compound. The prisoner touched Juan's sleeve and he looked at him more carefully. He wasn't an Arab like all the others. His hair and face were pale, although his skin was burned raw by the sun. "You Chaffee?" Juan asked.
"Yes. How did you know?"
"You've got Alana Shepherd to thank for your rescue." Chaffee sagged with relief.
"Thank God. We were told last night she was shot for trying to escape."
"Are you in any condition to fight?" The CIA agent tried to pull himself erect.
"Give me a gun and watch me."
Juan pointed to where Mark Murphy was securing the old boxcar to the pig's rear tow hooks. From this distance, the train car looked massive and the chain as thin as a silver necklace, but there was nothing he could do about it.
"Report to that guy over there. He'll take care of you."
"Thank you." Cabrillo looked at his watch. 8 minutes since the first shot fired. They had less than 10 more before a horde of gunmen arrived from the training camp, and just an hour until the Libyan military arrived and opened fire on anything that moved. Prisoners continued to stream toward the rail car, and no matter how Juan tried to urge them to hurry, they just couldn't. They were so far gone from their ordeal that even the offer of freedom couldn't make their bodies move faster than a painful shuffle. He could almost hear his watch ticking. Glancing over his shoulder, Juan watched them climb into the train, each one pausing when he or she was inside to help the next in line. It wasn't his watch Juan thought he heard. It was the rhythmic womp, womp, womp of an approaching helicopter. George Adams was still 20 minutes out. It had to be the terrorists' MI-8. It didn't matter that the train car was full anyway, and only one old woman was struggling to make it to the railhead from across the compound, while behind her tents and equipment burned, sending columns of smoke into the pinking sky. Time had run out.